Good morning, everybody. Thrilled to have to follow that. I'm Jill Campbell. I'm the Head of Investor Relations for ANZ. Thanks for coming along today. Welcome to the presentation of ANZ's financial results for the first half of financial year 2016. All the materials we're using today were lodged with the ASX, and they're also available on anz.com in the Shareholder Centre. We've got people joining us on a webcast and via the phone. Welcome to them. Hosting our Sydney results location is Mark Hand, the Managing Director of our Corporate and Commercial Business in Australia. And presenting from ANZ Centre in Melbourne today are our CEO, Shayne Elliott, and Acting CFO, Graham Hodges. They'll be presenting for around 30 minutes, after which time we'll go to Q&A, and I'll talk about the housekeeping for that when we do that section. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill. Good morning, everybody. So we'll just start with the financials. I'm very conscious that the headline you see in front of you is poor, but I'm equally confident that when you look through the headline to its components, you will agree that the result reflects strong core operating performance in our retail and commercial businesses here in Australia and New Zealand, and the impact of tough decisions taken to counter the immediate impact of more difficult trading conditions and to reposition ANZ for a stronger future. Overall, I am actually very pleased with the progress we have made as a team. Today, I want to leave you with five key messages. First, the strong performance in our retail and commercial businesses here at home. These businesses represent 80% of our earnings, and they're travelling really well, and I'll cover a little more about that in a minute. Secondly, our institutional business, which generates around 20% of our earnings, is facing difficult trading conditions as an industry globally. However, we have acted quickly and decisively to reduce assets, take the corresponding revenue hit, and started restructuring the cost base accordingly. Third, we've made tough decisions across the group to reposition for growth and return. In particular, what we have referred to as the specified items in our release. And Graham's going to cover those in more detail, but essentially there are four items. First, and I should mention that we've taken all of these charges above the line. First, the changes to our software amortisation policy, reflecting the reality of a shorter life cycle technology world, and also to increase management's accountability for technology investment in future. Second, we've taken a restructuring charge to allow further work on simplification, automation, delayering, and general productivity, which will drive benefits from today onward. Third, we've reset our minority investment valuations for AmBank and Bank of Tianjin in particular. And finally, we've noted here the impact of the sale of the Asanda dealer finance business, which is part of our ongoing capital and resource rebalancing focus. The fourth message is that while there is lots to be optimistic about, we've taken a conservative view and set the business for a subdued and challenging future, but in the process, providing the resourcing for the investments we want to make to positively transform our business. And finally, with respect to that transformation, we have a well-thought-out plan and we have already made strong progress on execution, which I will take you through. So first, just looking at our core Australia-New Zealand business. As I mentioned, the business here continues to show strong momentum, and that's driven by basic drivers like more customers choosing to bank with ANZ, growing market share in our key business lines, managing our margins well to deliver good revenue momentum, and importantly, also showing strong cost discipline, which has delivered, again, positive jaws in both businesses and strong reductions in the cost-to-income ratios. All in all, generating very good profit growth from both. In institutional, as I mentioned, we recognise the difficult trading conditions confronting institutional banking businesses globally. And as I said, we're taking a conservative view and resetting the business aggressively. First, we simplified the old institutional and international business to drive clarity and focus. Second, we agreed to reduce the capital allocated to this business, not by exiting product lines or geographies, but from a thorough review of current customers to ensure we're getting the right balance between solid customer outcomes and decent value-generating returns for shareholders. That will mean less but more valuable customer relationships going forward. In this half alone, we've made terrific progress, reducing the balance sheet by $17 billion and risk-weighted assets by $16 billion. These actions contributed to a big improvement in net interest margin, the first meaningful increase in 6 years. Reducing the balance sheet does come at a cost, and revenue fell slightly as a result. But we are already well advanced on actions to reset our cost base accordingly. So that summarises the businesses of our two core businesses, and Graham's going to cover business performance in more detail in a minute. I wanted to spend a little bit of time updating you on where we are focused as a management team and why. And we've taken a simple four-step approach to resetting our focus and priorities. First, to understand what we're good at as a bank. Second, to identify those long-term trends facing our customers. Three, to take into consideration the short-term operating environment. And then finally, the decisions required to position our business to benefit from that. So what are we good at? I think there are five key things. ANZ has a terrific retail banking base, and we are fortunate that our customer base is skewed to the more affluent in our society. Second, we have a strong and loyal small and medium business sector. Third, we clearly have the leading institutional customer franchises in both Australia and New Zealand, and a number four position, as we've talked about before, in Asia. Fourth, we have terrific capability with respect to regional trade, foreign exchange, debt capital markets, and cash management capabilities. And fifth, as you know, we have a truly differentiated regional footprint and a focus on connectivity. So what are the long-term trends facing our customers? We have identified four here. First, the well-known growth and transformation of Asia. Second, the shift from an economy driven by trade and goods and commodities to one dominated by data and services. Third, the rise in economic power and influence of the small and medium enterprise in our economies and also the self-employed. And last, the ever-increasing rise in consumer power and their expectations. These trends actually offer significant opportunity for banks able to position themselves effectively for leadership. And we're pretty excited about our ability to respond. However, that will take investment, and that shift cannot be undertaken without consideration of the short and medium-term operating environment. We need to recognise that the current outlook is dominated by headwinds, none of which are likely to change soon. From our perspective, that only puts the onus on us to drive change even harder. So what will a refocused ANZ look like? As at September last year, we had over half of the group's capital allocated to what was known as the Institutional and International Banking Group. Those businesses are challenged by margin compression, complexity, the credit cycle, and capital intensity. That means they generated a return on equity around our cost of capital, but with a deteriorating outlook. We need to reduce capital in this business and reset the cost base to improve returns. Those actions are underway, as I mentioned. Ideally, in the next 3 to 5 years, we would see the capital allocated to the institutional bank fall to the low 40% level. Wealth consumes around 10% of group capital, and it generates a return above our cost of capital, but as we all know, it too faces some industry challenges, primarily the regulatory framework, the related cost of doing business, and for life insurance, in which we are heavily focused, capital intensity. We have already made structural changes to the business, better aligning our wealth and retail offerings, and we have announced a strategic review of the business, and we'll be looking at all options to drive better outcomes for customers and shareholders. That review is due in a few months. And finally, our retail and commercial businesses here in Australia and New Zealand. They consume around 40% of group capital today. These are high return, high growth businesses where ANZ has key competitive strengths. While we have never limited resources allocated to these businesses, we do need to further increase the focus on customers and in particular digital. And we see these businesses grow as a proportion of the group's business portfolio. We will continue to manage that growth cautiously and responsibly. In terms of achieving the transformation, we are focused on four priorities, which I will walk through now. First is to create a simpler, better capitalised, better balanced and more agile bank. We will do that by reducing operating costs and risks, by removing complexity, by exiting low-return non-core businesses, reducing the reliance on low-return areas of institutional banking in particular, and further strengthening the balance sheet by rebalancing our portfolio. We've actually made really strong progress in this half, and actually in the second quarter in particular. We've reduced our absolute operating cost base on an adjusted pro forma basis. We've reduced the number of people in the organisation, and as we talked about, we've reduced our risk-weighted assets. We completed the sale of Asanda Dealer Finance and the Wealth Oasis platform. We merged Asia Wealth and Asia Retail, and we commenced a strategic review of that business. We've taken restructuring charges, I mentioned, and we repositioned our minority investments as group assets. And finally, we've taken the difficult decision to reduce the first half dividend. And I want to spend a little time on that. First of all, we recognise that the stability of the payout ratio and the ability to fully frank dividends are critical considerations for our shareholders. We also have to recognise that as we're talking here, we are undertaking a significant rebalancing of our business to drive fundamental value improvement. We believe that the adjustment to our payout ratio to 60 to 65% provides a more conservative and a sustainable base and fully frankable dividend per share. This is not a decision that we've taken lightly. But I would like to point out that as of yesterday's close, this dividend at 80 cents will deliver a yield of 6.7% or over 9.5% gross, which remains very competitive and well above our long-term average. Second area of focus is to focus on those areas where we can win. And we've identified those as making, buying and owning a home or starting, running and growing a small business in Australia and New Zealand easy. Second, we want to be the best bank in the world, not just in Australia, but be the best bank in the world for those customers who are driven by the movement of goods and capital in our region. And we've made a strong start here as well. I announced a new organisation structure and executive committee aligned with those focus areas. And I'd like to just introduce one of our new members of the team, Fred Olson, who's sitting here in the front, who will be running the Australia division. We've also agreed to merge the wealth distribution activities with our core retail business to align priority segments. We've simplified and refocused the institutional bank, and we've established a new digital banking division to support growth in priority areas. And finally, it's pleasing to see that after many, many years of being number four, we have moved to a number three market share position in Australia home lending. Third area of focus is to drive a purpose and values-led transformation of the bank. I recognise that this priority may appear a response to recent regulatory, media and political events. And frankly, there's some risk for me in identifying it as a key area of focus. But the reality is that we identified the need for change here some time before this became such a hot topic. Our industry is faced with a serious challenge. While no one has coined a catchy acronym for it, it is no less important or impactful, in my view, than a traditional financial crisis. In fact, it may be more difficult to manage, as our traditional toolbox of actions may not be effective. We acknowledge the very serious reputational challenges in our industry, and that we have let down many of our customers and stakeholders. These are challenges of ethics, conduct and community trust, and it therefore calls into question why we exist as an organisation, how we behave and the value we create for society at large. Now is not the right time or place to comment in depth on this issue, but suffice to say that driving a purpose and values-led transformation of ANZ is not about responding to poor press or political pressure, although these certainly focus the mind. It is about generating a sustainable company for all shareholders and all stakeholders, a company that is clear on what it stands for and why, a company that is truly able to identify and adapt to change, a company that encourages experimentation, but one that is conservatively set, prudently managed, a company that is respected by the broader community. I actually think we've made a good start with our uncompromising approach enforcing our code of conduct and our commitment to the review announced by the ABA. Finally, we want to focus on building a better everyday experience for our customers and our staff in order to compete in the digital age. And look, I realise that every bank says this, but we're really engaged, very determined, and we've made a great start. As you know, we appointed Maile Carnegie, the ex-CEO of Google Australia, to lead our new digital banking division. This is not some shadow team or just focused on cutting-edge innovation or running a lab. This is a real business division with real assets, people, project control, and a shared P&L set up in partnership with the core retail and commercial businesses to drive real and effective change across the group. Plus, we're not waiting for Maile to join, and we know that she cannot achieve these changes alone. We're actually really excited by some of the progress already being made. Most recently, in fact, just last Thursday, we became the first major Australian bank to launch Apple Pay, as you saw in the adverts, and we'll be launching Android Pay in the middle of the year. It's worth noting that Australia has the highest usage of PayWave, or tap and go, in the world, with 60% of all eligible transactions done that way. ANZ customers are even more keen on technology, processing 80% of eligible transactions on PayWave. It's also worth noting that 69% of our GoMoney users have an iPhone. So we have a rich source of existing customers who want Apple Pay, plus a vast number of potential new customers. Now, while clearly it's early days, the results have been outstanding. Customer downloads of Apple Pay are double what we saw when we launched our own mobile wallet. Online credit card applications are up 20% already. And on the day of the launch, online deposit applications were the highest on record, more than double the average, and with that high level continuing. ANZ's Apple Pay microsite saw 61,000 unique visitors across 4 days, making it the most visited ANZ microsite over that period. And finally, traffic to our core ANZ.com site has been running 6% higher since the launch. Now, it's worth noting that the vast bulk of this increased activity comes purely from social media engagement. Well, almost purely. We've only just launched television adverts on Sunday night, and we have yet to engage our customers directly. I'm offering to set up anybody on Apple Pay after this presentation who'd like to come forward. So, look, that was a progress report on the four business priorities. But importantly, I just want to close again on the financials before passing to Graham. The way that I think about the result, it's really in four pieces. There is a strong operating performance from our Australia, New Zealand retail and commercial businesses. That's a big driver of the result. Second, there clearly has been a turn in the credit cycle, as we have talked about over the half. Third, the very clear impact of the tough decisions we've taken to reposition institutional in particular. And fourth, the impact of the big four specified items, actions again taken to ready ANZ for a stronger future. I'll now pass to Graham for more details on the financials.
Thanks very much, Shane. As Shane said, cash profit for the first half of 2016 was $2.78 billion, down 24% PCP. A significant factor behind this result was the $717 million impact of specified items on the first half of 2016 profit. Excluding these items, pro forma profit was down 4% PCP and flat half on half. Importantly, the business maintained positive jaws and solid pre-provision growth, which helped offset increased provisions. I'd like to focus my comments today in three areas. First, the impact of the specified items. Second, the operating performance excluding the specified items. And third, some key areas of focus. The most significant adjustment in the specified items is our decision to change the bank's policy on capitalised software. There are two parts to this change. First, we have increased the threshold for capitalisation of software development costs. And second, we have tightened the criteria of what can be capitalised. So why the change? This decision recognises we are in an environment of more rapidly changing technology with shorter useful lives for software. And this is particularly true in a digital world, which has become an increasing area of our investment slate. It also reflects harder commercial disciplines on the business, where more of our investment needs to be paid for here and now, rather than be capitalised for someone else to pay for later. This commercial discipline brings a sharper focus on reducing cost to market and on realisation of benefits. This decision doesn't affect ANZ's total investment in technology, but does affect the timing of recognition of costs in the P&L. This policy change has had two impacts on our P&L in these results. First, this change, which is effective from 1st October 2015, has increased this half's operating expenses, but will have the effect of lowering amortisation costs in future years. In the first half of 2016, the increase in current half costs was $161 million from this change. Second, in this half, we've also seen a $468 million once-off cost impact of accelerating amortisation of previously capitalised software balances, in other words, balances that were sitting there as at 1st of October 2015, where the original project costs were under our revised threshold. So just to be clear, this is not an impairment. Obviously, you'll also be interested in what impact this change will have going forward. All other things being equal, and of course we know they never are, we will see our OPEX costs somewhat higher each half, as we have seen this half. But amortisation costs will decline as capitalisation balances decline. Looking forward, we are likely to see the impact of higher OPEX outweigh the benefits of lower amortisation for around the next 18 months. This impact, however, is being managed as part of our broader cost approach to cost management. The second specified item is the 138 pre-tax expenses associated with the first half 16 organisational restructures and provision for planned actions in the second half of 2016. Of the total $138 million, around two-thirds is for actions which will have benefits commencing in the second half. This provision is largely related to efficiencies associated with restructuring our business and support functions and will drive further sustainable cost benefits in the second half, and we're actually already seeing some of those come through. The third specified item relates to valuation adjustments of our Asian minority investments. We've taken a $260 million impairment charge on the value of our holdings in AmBank, reflecting the impact of the slower Malaysian economy on the valuation of the bank. Following the listing of the Bank of Tianjin and the Hong Kong Stock Exchange on the 30th of March this year, this investment has been reclassified as available for sale in the accounts, and we realised a modest FX gain of $29 million. The last specified item is the removing the impact of the $56 million first half benefits from the sale of the Asanda dealer finance business. Finally, in relation to these items, I would like to reinforce several important points. All of the items are accounted for above the line, that they have a minimal impact on capital, and aside from the impact of the sale of Asanda, they affect the timing of recognition of expenses and not the quantum of expenses. I'd now like to work through some highlights from our operating performance for the half. My focus here is on pro forma numbers, i.e. excluding the specified items. This slide shows the performance over the year and the half. The key points to note are positive jaws, reflecting the modest overall revenue growth, but strong cost disciplines and the impact of higher provisions. So first I want to talk to the income performance, excluding specified items, split by line of customer business. For the group, income grew 4% over the year and was up 2.4% in the half. If we look at the breakdown of where the income growth came from, retail banking, and particularly Australian retail, performed very strongly, up 15%, with New Zealand contributing well too, up 5% in New Zealand dollar terms. Income was up marginally in commercial banking, and in wealth we saw good growth in insurance and private bank. In institutional, income fell 9% or $257 million. This reflected the combined impact of specific business actions to reduce our balance sheet, with a 12% reduction in NLAs, tougher business and markets trading conditions over the period, and particularly commodity prices and the volumes of trade, and then interest rate impacts on markets' balance sheet earnings. The group's net interest margin performance for the half is the result of many different factors. At the group level, including markets and treasury, the net interest margin has declined 3 basis points over the half. The sale of Asander Dealer Finance contributed 2 basis points decline, and markets and treasury a further 4 basis points decline, which was largely due to the build-up of prime liquid assets. Excluding these, group margin increased 3 basis points despite absorbing a 2 basis points deterioration from higher funding costs. Disciplined repricing actions undertaken late in the second half of 2015 and more recently across the lending and deposit books have contributed 1 basis point improvement respectively. We're also seeing the positive impacts of the reduction in lower margin trade loans, which contributed 1 basis point to the overall 3 basis point improvement. The charts at the bottom of the page show margins by business. Australia's margin was up 1 basis point as the business managed a combination of strong competition, rising funding costs and some repricing. In institutional ex markets, margins were up 10 basis points due to balance sheet and pricing decisions. And in New Zealand, margins were down 7 basis points, reflecting competition and an ongoing switch to lower margin fixed loans. Total markets income was down 19% PCP, with the dollar impact evenly split between balance sheet earnings, which were down $116 million, or 45%, and sales, down $119 million, or 18%. Importantly, half-on-half, markets income was down only 3%. The lower markets income reflects the volatile environment, driven by factors such as uncertainty over the direction of the US dollar and US interest rates, falling commodity prices, and general concerns over global and regional growth. If we look at the first half 16 performance against the average first half markets results from 2012 to 2015, income for combined sales and trading, which we see as our customer-driven activity, at $899 million is 2% higher than the average $855 million seen in the past. This is a good indicator of the franchise strength even in difficult conditions. Balance sheet earnings, however, were around a third lower than the four-year average due to widening credit spreads in the last 12 months, the opposite of what happened over the previous 4 years. A key feature of today's results is the first half 16 reduction of $14 billion in total risk-weighted assets and the $15.5 billion reduction in credit risk-weighted assets. The breakdown of what drove the fall in credit risk-weighted assets is shown on the right-hand side of the chart. While around half of this decline is due to FX, the other half reflects portfolio shifts and asset sales, which have been actioned specifically to achieve this outcome. The sale of Asander has been well flagged, and there have been a continuing benefits flowing from our capital efficiency initiatives. I want to talk in more detail to the $2 billion lending reduction. The $2 billion reduction in credit risk-weighted assets is the first reduction since the first half of 2010. What is important to note is the mix shift underway, with continuing growth in our high-return domestic franchises in Australia and New Zealand and the $9.2 billion credit risk-weighted asset reduction in institutional's balance sheet. In Insto, the impact has largely been on the reduction of net lending assets in international, which is $14.9 billion of the total reduction of $16.6 billion. This is a result of a deliberate decision to reduce lower-returning assets from the balance sheet, to improve overall returns, to manage capital and to manage costs. And that's what also showed up in the higher net interest margin for Insto ex-markets. The expense performance is one of the highlights of this result. Pro forma expenses, in other words, excluding specified items, rose just 0.3% PCP and fell 1.4% half on half. FTEs have fallen 4.6% PCP and 2.5% half on half, and have continued to decline into the second half, and most has been mostly driven by attrition. This cost performance reflects the impact of a wide range of initiatives over more than 6 months to simplify our organizational structure, improve productivity, reduce duplication, and permanently remove costs from the business. The restructuring provision taken in the first half of 2016 will see costs fall further in the second half of 2016 and help re-baseline the group's ongoing cost base. I'd now like to turn to my last section, the key areas of focus. Our increase in provisions this half have been well flagged ahead of the result and are in line with what we said during the half. The 223 million provision delta half on half was largely in institutional, and the split of where it came from is shown on the right-hand side of the chart. Around half of the provision increase came from the Australian institutional business, with most of that from a small number of single-name customer exposures, as outlined in our 24 March disclosures. The other 50% of the increase was in Asia, of which half again related to actions by management to exit emerging corporate loan book. The small CP reduction in the half reflected transfers into IP. We've seen a small increase in gross impaired assets in this half, back to the second half of 2014 levels. On the right-hand side of the chart, you can see the asset portfolio shift underway that Shane talked to earlier. Fewer exposures in institutional and increased retail business. If we look at the forward indicators of credit quality, they point to a continuation of the modest weakening of the credit cycle in Australia, which has been evident for a couple of halves now. In Australia, this is most evident in Western Australia, although arrears are up a little in some other states too. More recently, Queensland has seen some small improvement, while New South Wales remains the best performing state from a credit quality perspective. In New Zealand, conditions are still cyclically strong, with dairy being the main area where some stress has emerged, due to lower commodity prices. On capital, we've seen a 76 basis point net capital generation in the half, leaving our March 2016 APRA Common Equity Tier 1 at 9.81%, or 14% on an internationally comparable basis. Looking forward into 2016, we show the 60 basis point impact of the 25% risk weighting floor on Australian mortgages announced by APRA in July 2015 and to take effect from the 1st of July this year. This is up from the pro forma number at the full year 2015 results of 55 basis points due to stronger portfolio growth in the first half 16. Even with this impending deduction, we remain comfortably within our preferred capital range. Finally, I'd like to talk briefly to the dividend outcome for this half. The 80 cents per share first half payout is 6 cents or 7% lower than the first half of 2015. The decision to modestly lower the dividend was taken after considering a range of factors and with a view of ensuring that our dividend per share is struck at a level which is sustainable in the context of these factors. These include our confidence in the ongoing capital generation from our strongly performing retail and commercial businesses in Australia and New Zealand, the reshaping of our institutional business, and especially the continued capital efficiency initiatives, credit quality trends, and the impact of expected asset sales. By resetting the dividend modestly, we will see the dividend payout ratio reduce over time to a range 60 to 65%, which we think gives the right balance of sustainable dividends per share and fully franking the dividend. The final dividend is expected to be at least the same as the interim dividend in cents per share. So with that, I'll pass back to Shane to conclude.
So just a couple of more comments before we go to Q&A. So look, while our priority remains creating value for the long term, we recognise that we also have to manage the transition and deliver in the short term. We've covered the longer term priorities. I just want to talk to you a little bit about the short term focus. And I want to reassure you that the Executive Committee at ANZ is focused on three fundamental things. First, managing earnings. Secondly, capital generation. And third, remaining unquestionably strong. Subdued growth that we've outlined and lower revenue as a result of our tough calls to reduce non-core and low-return assets, coupled with the rising credit costs, puts pressure on us to manage the overall business prudently. And in this half, we've been able to aggressively attack costs to offset those impacts on an adjusted pro forma basis. Managing productivity will continue to be a focus of this team. Secondly, without proactive management, organic capital generation will suffer, but we are focused on also managing balance sheet growth and other levers to improve capital generation as we've done in this half. The chart on the right here shows that while we have seen a very different composition of capital generation and consumption this half versus previous halves, we have managed the levers well to produce a better outcome. And finally, we understand the imperative to remain unquestionably strong. And we agree with APRA that this involves a wide range of factors, including management capability. But when thinking about our balance sheet, it's worth noting that ANZ remains one of only a handful of banks globally in the top quartile on both a capital and leverage basis. And we will continue to ensure that we're prudently managed with a sound balance sheet and risk appetite. And then just to close, in terms of the business outlook and our future focus, we believe we will continue to see strength and growth in our Australia and New Zealand core businesses. We're going to continue to focus on repositioning the institutional bank, focused around target market customer selection. Three, we'll continue to strengthen the balance sheet. Fourth, continue focusing on rebalancing the portfolio, as I laid out, in terms of capital, productivity and overall simplification. And finally, the execution of those four priorities. I am pleased with the progress we have made. We have a strong, diverse and experienced leadership team. We are completely united and focused on building a better bank, and we're managing prudently, proactively and with purpose. We are making the tough decisions, we are moving at pace, and we are preparing the bank for a stronger and sustainable future. Thank you.
Okay, Q&A. So, usual process. We will start in the room here in Melbourne. We'll then move to Sydney. I'll hand over to Mark. And then we'll finish up with questions from the phone. And with that, we'll start with Craig, please.
Thanks. Craig Williams from Citi. You've made a good start on reducing low-returning assets, on right-sizing headcount and perhaps resetting the dividend to a more sustainable level. Investors would perhaps like more clarity on what you hope the reshaped business may end up looking like. Can you enunciate this vision a bit more for us in terms of risk-weighted asset reduction, timeframes for exits in minorities and FTE, noting your friends down the road, I think you'd probably end up with something like 35,000 headcount for a reshaped business.
So I think, first of all, we have a large and complex, diverse business, right? And as I laid out, there's a lot for us to focus on. The business that we have today, the way that I think about it, Craig, is we have, as I said, a little bit more than half of our capital allocated to the old IOB business. I would like the business of the future to be more like 60-40. 40%, probably a little over that, but 40-ish percent allocated to institutional and 60% around our retail and commercial businesses, including whatever the outcome is within the wealth business, because essentially it's a retail-focused business. That's what I would like. Now, when you do the maths about trying to grow your way into that outlook, and if I assume, let's just say for 5-year outlook, for sake of argument, given the lack of, given the low capital consumption of the retail and commercial, it's really hard to grow your way into that position. The only way you can do it is actually by both growing responsibly in retail and commercial and shrinking institutional. And the challenge for us is to do that responsibly. So in terms of what does the future look like, 60-40-ish, I think the returns on the retail and commercial, given what we know about the rules today, are still going to remain in the low 20s. And it is our job and our intention to restore the returns in our institutional business into the kind of low double-digit areas, call it. We've said before about the kind of 13-ish%. We believe that's doable. That will require a significant amount of work on cost, as you rightly point out, and it will mean that we need to be a smaller, more nimble bank. I don't have a target in terms of FTE. That's not the way we think about it. It's really about having that capital allocation right. But it's going to require a significant amount of work on cost, as you point out.
And whilst welcome, does the above-the-line treatment of your restructuring today reflect a likely ongoing profile of restructuring charges yet to come?
I think I'm not taking credit for it, but since my time as CFO, we've had an uncompromising view on how we think about the line, if you will, and what's above and below it. And from our point of view, everything is above the line except accounting noise. And, you know, therefore, restructuring charges, I think, is a broad statement of just part of what we do. And therefore, we are accountable for them, and they should impact, they should be above the line. They should impact executive compensation and all those things. We quite rightly would expect to be measured on the benefits of those restructuring decisions, and so we should be measured on taking the charges as well.
Any more from the floor here? Looks like it's over to you, please, Mark.
Okay, thanks. Might just get you to say your name and where you're from for the people on the phone.
Thanks. John Mott from UBS. Just a bit of a follow-up question on the runoff of the book in Asia. And if you look so far at the balance sheet reduction, nearly all of it's come through the transaction banking, or the vast majority of it's come through transaction banking, which I can understand runs off a lot faster. The global loans business hasn't run off anywhere near as quickly, and it's probably longer duration. So can you just touch on that? Is this just an ongoing process or runoff over time? And given what you're seeing throughout there, I think you reiterated institutional loans, or institutional business, you think you can get a 13% ROE target, but some of your competitors, Standard Chartered, for example, are talking 8 by 2018, hopefully 10 by 2020. Even if you do run this business off and revert to more Australian business, is that just overly optimistic?
So good questions both. So yes, the focus of the runoff, remember the focus we have here is going through from a customer perspective and saying, we've gone and built a network that is, in many ways, it's a beautiful thing, right? And it has fabulous capability. We have to ensure that the customers that are availing themselves of our capability are paying for it, and we generate a balanced return for our shareholders. And so we're going through customer by customer and making sure that that's the case. Now, in terms of making the hard decisions around reductions, the reality is that in the short term, it's much easier to let short-term trade assets run off because the average tenor in those is, 30, 60, 90 days. And so we can make those decisions much faster. And that's what you're seeing here. That does not mean that we are only reliant on the trade book for reduction. Trade's actually a pretty important part of our business. We love the trade business. We want to do more of it, but we want to do the right business. Global loans is harder. To give you an idea, average loan tenor is going to be closer to 3 years. You have something in excess of $20-odd billion a year naturally coming up for repricing. And so those repricing opportunities are the opportunities to have a discussion with the customer about the right return, whether we're the right bank for them, et cetera. This is not a strategy about, across the board, sales of loan portfolios. That's not a very practical or realistic outcome. It's about managing customers properly. So you're going to see more activity in the loan book. The other thing I would just say on that, it is not about across the board slashing the RWA or loan book. We are increasing in some areas. There's some businesses that we do and want to do more of. So it's about switch, and it's really about getting focused on those customers that value what we do for them and exiting others. So you're going to see significant transition. When we are not finished in the reduction or the focus in our RWA, there is more to come. If you're going to ask me for a time, I'd say that is probably for the next 12 to 18 months, that'll be the predominant kind of trend there until we set it on a more sustainable footing. In terms of returns, it's also a good question. The reality is that our business is very different to others, and you've talked about Standard Chartered, and it's certainly very different to those. We do have the benefit of very, very strong domestic franchises that on average are higher return. If you carve through the institutional bank today and look at our Australia and New Zealand businesses, and you just look at those customers that are totally on strategy, doing what we say we're good at, right, and the ones that we have meaningful relationships with, we absolutely produce returns today on those relationships in the teens. And so it can be done. What it requires for us to do is be focused on that and take a, you know, frankly, a pretty kind of ruthless approach in terms of the way we service customers in terms of our cost base. So I believe the 13% is reasonable. It's not going to be easy. I'm not suggesting that for a second. It's not going to be easy. But it's absolutely doable given the franchise and the strength that we have today.
And if I just add, Jonathan, is this mic on? Yeah. You know, you can see from the chart that I put up there that we had a $6.8 billion reduction in loans in international, but we had a $0.8 billion increase in Australia, and that's sort of back to Shane's point that we do get, you know, good returns where we've got a good client relationship. So, I mean, it's as you said, customer by customer.
Without belabouring, there's one other thing worth noting. Some of the exit of assets, in particular in Asia and around the loans book, has been to do with, again, the kind of broader target market selection, which is more in the emerging corporate segment. You know, what we're good at, when I went through stuff, is large multinational, international companies that move things around. That's where we have competitive strength. We had attempted in the past and had acquired a little bit in RBS, kind of a middle market portfolio, not very big, in Asia, and we're progressively running that down aggressively as well. And that's having that's had an impact in this half. And then we'll continue to do so.
Good morning, Richard Biles, Morgan Stanley. Shane, there's a lot of decisive action in this result, but the key uncertainty for the outlook is credit quality. You've told us in recent years that Asia is lower credit risk than Australia because of the short tenor of trade finance and the high proportion of investment-grade lending. Yet in this result, Asia institutional has $200 million in loan losses on 50-odd billion of loans, and Australia only has $100 million in loan losses on a higher loan balance in the institutional book. So can you please outline some of the factors driving that loan loss charge in Asia, and can you comment on what you expect for Asia going forward?
I liked your question up until you said but. The reality is, Richard, it's a fair question as well. The reality is that some of the losses that are coming through now reflect the reasonably significant deterioration in a couple of markets in Asia that have been probably a little bit surprising, notably Indonesia, but also some others. So that's A. B, it also reflects our decision to exit certain segments of the market, as I mentioned, that emerging corporate sector. Maybe it's not inevitably, but it's understandably when you do take those decisions to exit some of those relationships, it can have the consequence of increasing your provision levels as part of that, and that's very much evident in the numbers that we have today. I think that the Asia book, and we have probably talked about this before, in many ways is a bit of a barbell, and we have a very large proportion of that book, high 80% of that book that is investment grade. Very, very high quality, very short term, lots of FI, sovereign kind of exposure, unfortunately pretty low return, but nonetheless. But it still leaves you with the 12-15%, which isn't. And it's the 12 or 15%, which rather than being just nudged up close to the investment grade, is actually, in reality, a big step down. And that's the portfolio that is emerging corporate and others, and that's the portfolio that has deteriorated more rapidly. And, you know, again, we've taken the decisive action to get ahead of it and clean it up.
Jared Martin from Credit Suisse. Just to follow up on that question and then to ask another, the fact that you said in the previous answer that you were going to continue to reduce RWA for another 12 to 18 months, does that mean that the emerging corporate Asia bad debt is likely to continue to be at this level or even higher for the next three periods? And the fact that the bad debt number that you took on the single names was only $100 million versus a peer yesterday that took significantly more than that, that you were unwilling to put down a statement that second half bad debt charges would be lower than first half, as your peer did yesterday.
So a couple of comments on that. In terms of the RWA reduction, I think it's important to say that that is a focus around the institutional book, okay? We will be increasing our RWA in our retail businesses, partly because of capital intensity and new rules that will just happen, and partly we will be growing the business. So that is a institutional focus, and it's part of that rebalancing. In terms of the ongoing exit of the emerging corporate sector, that still has some way to go. And yes, there will be further bad debt charges as a result. We would not expect the run rate of that to materially change in the next 12 to 18 months, right? So we wouldn't expect that to spike up or down for that matter, which should continue at about the same level. Just on that, I think Graham referred to it in his numbers. If you look at the provision charge, about half of was for Australia. The half was in Asia. Of the half in Asia, half of that again was essentially related around this portfolio reduction. So that you can figure out the numbers yourself to see what that core would be. What was the second part of your question? Was the
and then with the single names, it was only $100 million additional.
No, I think I guess that depends on your starting point and your exposures, and because from what we understand, our single names are not necessarily the same as other single names, so there's some overlap, but they're slightly different. All I can say is that our level of provisioning is prudent. It does depend on whether your exposures are secured or not secured, et cetera, and the tenors and all that other stuff. But I think in terms of the guidance for the second half, I just don't know that that's a prudent thing for us to be doing. In reality, the whole point about the single names that we saw in the first half is that they were surprised. They weren't expected to, in terms of timing or amount. And so it's a little bit hard to make predictions about surprises. And I think our view on the economy is the economy's running well. It's good. It's subdued. But it is prone to accidents and surprises as we go through this transition. So we're just going to manage the place really tightly and prudently. And I don't think it's prudent for us to be making forecasts about the second half.
Brian Johnson, CLSA. I wish I could say congratulations, Shane, but I must admit this kind of looks as though this is half the beating that perhaps shareholders were expecting. But when you have a look at it, I've got two questions. If you have a look at slide 41, you say that this 60 to 65% dividend payout ratio includes expected capital requirements. As we sit here today, we still don't know what unquestionably strong means. We don't know what the Basel Committee stuff on corporate lending, on bigger ticket lending basically means. We don't yet know what happens to residential investment property lending. Yep. The first question is, since you've put that out there, could you explain to us exactly what you're expecting in the capital requirements, but perhaps more particularly, what are the key capital drivers that would actually drive the payout ratio below that figure?
So, Brian, we can only manage on what we know about the future, right? And we can only manage on what we've known about it. If we were to manage on what might be, the only way we could do that is not have any dividends at all, to be totally prudent. So we can't do that. So we have to make some assumptions. And the assumptions we've made here are about the known direction and announcements. So, for example, the increase in RWA around mortgages in Australia, so we've factored that in. We've taken those factors in. We believe, for what we know now, that our capital levels in the low nines are prudent and that we'll have sufficient organic capital generation and other levers to pull should that change in a reasonable way. We can't set the bank for, you know, shocks to our capital settings, as I said, or we wouldn't be able to pay any dividend in that situation. That's always going to be a judgment call. I don't know if you want to add to it.
I think on the broader Basel agenda, I mean, the guidance that's been given by the regulator is that they'll assess that at the end of 2016, and there will be some implementation after that. So, you know, that's not a long way out, but it's still, uncertain exactly on quantum and timing. And so, you know, we've made some judgments around that, but, you know, we still wait to see where that comes. But I think the guidance we've been getting from the regulators is that that's, you know, no earlier than next year we'll see the detail of that, and then we're likely to get some sort of implementation period.
And I think, Brian, you know, we could have taken the opposite view, which is to say, well, let's not do anything, let's just wait and see, because there's still lots of unknowns, we'll wait. But I think we've taken a prudent approach to this and balanced what we think the capital requirements are going to be, taking into account, as I say, all the levers we have at our disposal around generating capital, and trying to do the right thing by shareholders as well and getting that balance right. And that's why we've taken a prudent approach. and acted to make a decision rather than just deferring.
And the second question is, if you have a look at slides 90 and 91, and it's been a pretty consistent theme in the questioning today, what you've done as far as running off the low return risk assets makes a hell of a lot of sense. But when you have a look up in Asia, we've still got a lot of longer duration assets that still sit on your book. In January and February, the world was awash with basically the world is ending. You started to see currencies adjust. It kind of looked a little bit like what triggered the Asia crisis in basically 1997. I'd just be interested, Shane, what is the scenario both in terms of interest rates or currency that perhaps we could see a shock coming through, in which case you're not getting out of those loans fast enough?
So our portfolio in Asia, as we've talked about, is heavily weighted towards investment-grade names. It's heavily weighted towards financial institutions, and it's heavily short-term, actually. And as we've said here, if we look at China, for example, 87% of the EAD is less than 1 year. So I understand that it's not 100%. Obviously, there's some tenor in there, and we have to manage that prudently. The reality is I think we have a prudent portfolio in China. There is all sorts of scenarios that one could construct that would end up with, impacts on our provisioning numbers. And I think we don't manage it as a series of independent portfolios. Obviously, we look at it the whole. I mean, that's kind of a long-winded way of saying we're comfortable with our portfolio. Yes, we recognise we have to reset it for a more subdued future. From my perspective, the exposures that we have in our Asia book are being managed aggressively and prudently.
And I think, Brian, just if you looked at the numbers there on China, I mean, remember that around half of that sort of booked offshore. So it's while it's sort of notionally a China risk, it's actually their assets in other jurisdictions as well, which is sort of somewhat different.
I suppose, Graham, what really perhaps concerns me more, and I think it's a general feeling around the room, is that if we have a look in the 2015 year, the collective provision overlay was reduced to, I'm guessing, around $25 million. If I look at the slides today, I can see that you've still got more exposure to New Zealand dairy than anyone else. I can see that the arrears rate is turning up. You've still got a lot of Asia. You've still got a lot more than your peers of mining services. I'm just puzzled as to why we didn't go one step further in this result and actually establish a collective provision overlay for what would appear to be exposures relative to your peers that are higher risk.
So, first of all, making decisions around collective overlays is not something we just sit around in a room and make up, okay? We have to go through a reasonably rigorous process. Secondly, that assumes that our starting points are all the same. You know, there are other ways, we have to make account by account, making sure that our risk rating is right is the primary way of making sure that we're well provided for rather than just relying on overlays. Yeah? We do not believe as of today, where we sit today, that we can justify putting a management overlay of any material amount in place. I think, to your point, Brian, given all of the other decisions we've made, it would not be in our interest to shy away from that decision if it was the right thing to do. If we felt strongly, clearly we've just laid out, we've been prepared to make a whole bunch of other tough decisions, so I find it hard to imagine that if we had come to that conclusion that we would shy away from it. So we don't think it's necessary right now.
And I think just remembering back a couple of years, we did take an overlay for the resources change. What we've seen is that slowly unfold. And I think the overlays generally come where you've seen a rapid shock where the risk grades aren't keeping up with what's sort of going on. But the deterioration that we've seen across the resources sector or the change that's going on there has now been going for some time. And the risk grades in the book, as Shane said, they're the ones that really tell us where things are going. And they've been keeping up with that over these last couple of years. So we think that's sort of the way the book would normally work. It's only where you've got shocks that you would generally think about overlays.
Hi, it's Scott Manning from JP Morgan. Interested in the comments around the dividend on slide 41, taking into account the impact of expected asset sales on earnings. Just trying to understand whether that means that you're effectively putting a line in the sand around that 80 cents per share, regardless of potential future earnings weakness as you do exit partnerships, so that cents per share dividend is preserved given those headwinds to earnings?
To some extent, Yes. I mean, clearly what we're trying to do here, as we said, we've set a number that we think is conservative and sustainable in, dividend per share basis. Now, obviously, you know, the world can change. But based on what we know today, we believe that's a conservative, well-set dividend per share. We've also said that in the medium term, we want to have a glide path towards a 60 to 65% payout ratio. Now, clearly it is our intention to improve the underlying earnings capability of this organisation. And so we want to grow, and understand there'll be restructuring, but we're going to grow the business and bring down the and glide into that 60 to 65% dividend payout ratio over time. All we're trying to say here is in trying to figure out what's a conservative setting, we've taken into account the probability of other factors happening, like, for example, asset sales, right? But I don't want to overemphasise that. The asset, we are not relying on those asset sales in order to maintain the dividend or meet capital ratios. As I said, we've taken a conservative approach. I don't know if you want to add anything
well,
to that.
Well, I mean, the only point I'd add is that we often hear about, you know, the benefit of the asset sales on capital, but what we're acknowledging here is that it has an earnings effect as well. And so we're actually looking at the balance of those two, obviously.
So given those dynamics, that the lower earnings won't necessarily flow through to the dividend, that means that you will have the capital available from those exits. Does that mean it gets isolated or quarantined in group capital ratios, or is there any prospects at some point that you can actually either return that to shareholders? Because I given deploying it in the domestic business is going to be too slow to change that mix.
I mean, you know, it's all going to depend on the regulatory world we live in terms of what the required capital ratios are going forward. I mean, I think we have a fabulous asset here. We have $5-odd billion in these minority investments, which are not going to be easy, which are a capital deduction today, which we can release over time. And if they're required to sustain the existing business we have, great. And if they're surplus to requirements, that's another terrific thing for shareholders, and we have to decide at that time. You know, the difficulty here is, you know, obviously there's lots of common timing issues to hear. But I think we've got, a great asset there. I think, you know, but my commitment here is to say we can't run the bank assuming or taking for granted that those asset sales will happen on a certain time. They are complex, and it's quite rightly you hold us to account because we've talked about it before. It's hard to predict. So we're not relying on them. They will be a net benefit to shareholders.
Brad Lemaitre from APP. Question on the FTEs in the institutional bank. They fell by 6% in the second half, 15, another 4%. First half, 16. I gather from what you're saying that we should expect similar reductions going forward over the next few years, and that there will actually be no significant restructuring provision in respect of redundancies in that part of the bank. And by significant, I'm talking about hundreds of millions of dollars to effect a quick change. You're thinking about natural attrition?
Yeah, I mean, yes, Brett. So the FTE reduction has been pretty meaningful. I mean, you know, those are meaningful numbers. Lots of it has been managed through natural attrition, but some of it has actually been, that's what we've used the restructuring charge that we announced today. Just as the restructuring charge today, the 138 pre-tax, about a third of that actually relates to actions that are already taken in the half, and so some of it will be there. Restructuring the business is going to be an ongoing thing, but it is about a series of relatively small, thoughtful steps rather than, you know, slashing things across the board. So I think it'll just be continuing tightening up in that business. It's not our intention to do a, you know, multi-thousand people kind of announcement or anything. And for the reason, because we don't need to, and it's not the right thing to do for the business. We actually have a really good business in institutional. Hmm. Okay, the world's changed. You know, yes, we probably got a little ahead of ourselves in growth, but the world's changed at the same time. The competitive landscape, the economic outcome in many of our markets, the regulatory stuff. So we have to reset, and that resetting means it's going to be smaller. Okay, but it's going to be smaller and better. And the reality is, as I said, it is a great business, and we'll get it back on its feet pretty quickly, I think.
And I'd add, it's the business which is probably undergoing the most change, as you've noted, and therefore, not surprisingly, just over a third of that restructuring provision
is really in the institutional space. So, you know, that's sort of, that's why it's focused there.
Oh, and the only other thing I would say is, Mark was just winking at me there, it's a good point. One thing that's worth noticing about noting about the FT reductions. Look, first of all, nobody likes to make these. These are difficult decisions. We have loyal staff and we want to, they're an important stakeholder as well. But we need to right-size the business. But what we're doing this time is making sure that we're doing it prudently and responsibly. And it's not just about the people at the bottom of the pyramid. We've taken some, it's about the restructuring of the business. We've merged units, taken out clutter in terms of our organisation. And so, in fact, not maybe so much in FTE numbers, but certainly in savings, a lot of the savings come from very senior executives that have left the building. And again, that's not a great thing to be proud of, but we're trying to manage that responsibly across the whole organisation. It's a benefit of simplification, not just, you know, across-the-board cuts.
So since you signalled the shrinking of the business and everyone understands that, how do you go about making sure that the best people stay?
Because the best people actually are committed to the vision that we have for the business. It's about communicating a business, a vision for a better and stronger bank. And I think they, well, you know, I believe they buy into it. I mean, one thing we have, well, we have lots of things, advantages, but, you know, look, I know and love that business. I used to run it. And I would hope that a lot of the people in that business, you know, trust me in the sense of, you know, this is a business that I'm proud of. And so we do want to look after it. And our best people that understand that. And actually, I am very, very encouraged by the team that Mark Whelan has built. This is a team of really exceptional individuals who are really coming together strongly with a unified purpose, who themselves, they want to be better. And they can be, and they know it. And so they're making, to be honest, the things that we asked Mark and the team to do, this team has outperformed on. They've done more. Not because they know it has to be done.
Andrew Triggs from Deutsche Bank. Just a question on the global markets weakness. It looked like a fairly soft second quarter driven by Australia and New Zealand. A few questions there. Firstly, what was the timing of the valuation adjustments, which were a drag quarter on quarter? Secondly, how much of the weakness was due to customer runoff versus just less volatility or the wrong kind of volatility?
So
thirdly, just the outlook for this business as the institutional footprint shrinks.
Sure. So in terms of valuation adjustments, we'll have to get back to you on that. I'm not sure about the timing on that, to be honest. In terms of the business, yes, there was a weakness in Australia and New Zealand. The weakness, essentially, there were two areas of... Well, there was one area of weakness and then there was a shift. So the area of weakness, the slowdown, has been around balance sheet trading. And I think there's a chart in there that shows that the amount that we generated from balance sheet trading was a lot lower than we've done in the past. That's not surprising given what's happening in corporate credit spreads, A, and B, frankly, the intense scrutiny, quite rightly, on the marketplace about the way that that market operates. And so that's going to be slowed down. I would not expect that business to rebound or change from where it is. I think it's at a sustainable level now. And secondly, we're not asking the business to rebound or to grow that piece of it, right? We want them to manage it prudently. So that's that first one. The second change that's happened in markets, and if you look at the sales and trading number that Graham talked about, actually the total's running at about what we've seen over the past few years. But there has been a shift. And the shift has been actually foreign exchange business has done pretty well. It's the rates side of it. Customer activity about making decisions about fixing or floating interest rates has slowed right down. That's probably not unsurprising given the view in the marketplace today that rates are more likely to fall than not. And if you know, in a very simple sense, most of our customers have debt and they're interested in fixing rates, they're going to defer those decisions. And so that's the sort of activity that we've seen a shift in. That's just kind of normal. I think in terms of running the business going forward, we're really good at markets. We've got a great franchise. We're a leader when it comes to corporate foreign exchange. We've got some very great strengths in that business and we've shown an ability to manage it through all sorts of cycles. But it's not the sort of business you can just ask for more and more and more and consistent growth, you know, half on half. That's when you start to get into trouble. What we need to do is actually, in a funny way, is ask for less. We need to reset expectations from that business and not be so reliant on it in terms of a driver of our income. And that's what we're going to do in the future. So it's going to be really important because it's an important part of our customer franchise, but we're not going to put undue pressure on it from a trading and balance sheet perspective. Now, that puts a pressure on us to get our cost by again, it was all circular, puts pressure on us, not just in markets, but across the whole bank to get our cost base right. Because we're making active decisions to reduce low-return assets, take pressure off trading as a source of earnings and some other things we're doing. Well, we have to therefore take some pretty decisive action on cost, and we're doing that by taking out complexity, exiting other businesses, et cetera, et cetera.
And just on the first part of your question, I think it was about a $30 million per quarter valuation change, and I think it was slightly larger in the second quarter on the DVA.
We've finished questions here in Sydney, so maybe back to Jill for the phone.
Thanks, Mark. Do we have any questions on the phone? Now imagine that you're at the back of the room and I can't see you. Okay, three. Okay. Can we start putting those through, please?
Yes, your first question comes from Victor German with Macquarie Bank. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My question, Shane, is again on the dividend, and in particularly around the guidance or your expected payout ratio. I think if I look at it historically, one of the key reasons ANZ had lower payout ratio was, or the three key reasons were higher growth, higher balance sheet growth. It was a generally lower returning business, and you had lower franking credits. Your presentation today effectively outlines the pathway of effectively addressing all three of those. Why is it that in that sort of context you think that you need to reduce the payout ratio rather than perhaps keeping it?
So that's a fair observation, and I think you're right. You know, we've always recognised the fact that our strategy was oriented around growth, and therefore we needed to retain more of our earnings in order to fund that growth. I think that was the primary difference, and the nature of, you know, the nature of our business being having more reliance on offshore earnings meant we generated lower franking credits on average, in a sense. So that's all true. The reality is, though, that the changes that we're talking about and that I mentioned in terms of rebalancing our portfolio are going to take time. And I mentioned earlier, you know, the outlook is more of a five-year outlook of where we're going to be, and recognising that there are lots of moving parts in there that will impact our result over that time. And so we want to set the dividend prudently. Could we have maintained it and kind of hung on and kind of gritted it through it? I guess so, but we don't want to run a bank like that that's on the edge all the time. And then, because I think what that does, Victor, it means we end up making poor decisions just to keep a dividend or a payout ratio to meet some ratio. So we've taken a view about, you will have heard today, I think, I didn't count how many times I used the word prudent or conservative. And, you know, that is the way we want to run the bank. And we want to have it. We want to know that when we turn up on a Monday morning, that unless somebody does something really stupid, the bank will continue to grow and generate capital and pay out a responsible dividend that's, you know, competitive for our shareholders and do the right thing by customers. That's what we want. And if things go really well and we achieve more than we hope for and we do get some asset sales or we you all sign up to Apple Pay tomorrow and we do whatever it is, maybe we'll be in a position to increase the dividend in the future, but that's not the decision for today.
Right. So maybe I misunderstood, because I guess kind of the way I read your announcement was that you were targeting in the medium term to get to 60 to 65 payout ratio, and you're planning to get there over time. It sounds to me like over time you actually think you can sustain a higher payout ratio, and 60 to 65 is something that you want to get to relatively quickly and potentially grow it over time. Is that the right way of thinking about it?
Well, no, the way that I think about it, so if you look through the specified items today, the payout ratio today is of today's dividend is about 67%, I think, something like that, right? So we're not far off it. And if we're at 67, putting aside, you know, future, things that might be in that bucket of one-offs, a little bit of growth gets us to a 60 to 65 pretty quickly, actually. So that's the place we want to be. And I just, you know, we think 60, when we do the maths, we do the models just like you do, and we think about all the factors we have. And remember, as Brian pointed out, there's still a big unknown here about the end game in terms of capital. We think we would rather have a conservative, sustainable dividend that we're confident in rather than one where we, lack confidence in our ability to do the right thing. So it's a glide path. We're going to grow the DPS over time, hopefully. Obviously, that's what we would like to do, and grow our way into a lower payout ratio.
Right, with a view of potentially increasing over time.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Look, don't give me... Yeah, absolutely. I think that's fair.
60-40 split, and you're looking at 60% in businesses that generate, you think, over 20%, and 40% generates 13%.
Yeah, but it's not there yet.
ROE than you currently have.
Yeah, I get it. I understand. I think we're just talking about time frames. I totally agree with that. We are here to build a better, stronger bank that one day will have a much better return and therefore an ability to do that. I think we're just talking about timing. I don't want us to sit for the next 3 to 5 years just hanging on, waiting for that to happen. I think this is a helpful step to reset. But I take your point. Yes, absolutely. We are not, just to be clear, we are not saying we are forever locked into a 60 to 65%. That as a result of these changes and repositioning the bank, all else being equal, we will be a higher earning, higher return bank that will be able to sustain a higher payout ratio. Yes.
Understood. And then just one point of clarification. I mean, one of the things that obviously investors don't really like to see is reduction in absolute value of dividends. I understand your view around payout ratio, but should we take this 80 cents dividend as kind of your new benchmark for the first half, which you will intend to grow from? Is that kind of the way we read it?
So we historically, we've always paid out a high in the second half dividend is higher than the first half by around 10%, actually, historically. What we said this time, in terms of consideration, we understand that people want some level of confidence around the dividend per share. We said 80 cents in the first half. We said, hopefully, very clearly, the second half will be at least the same dividend, all right, at the second half. You can take it from that, barring any significant shift in our portfolio or business lines, yes, we are trying to establish a new baseline in DPS.
Okay. No, that's helpful. Thank you.
But we would hope, but in doing that, just so obviously if it's, let's just say it is 80 cents, obviously we're going to rebalance and it will be unlikely that our second half dividends are going to be 10% higher going forward. We're trying to rebalance that as well.
But yeah. You don't expect need for further rebalancing in the first half 17?
No.
So first half 17 should grow on this half?
It should be the same or more. Yeah, that would be the normal kind of assumption from what we've said today, yes. Barring any, as I said, barring significant change to our portfolio.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Andrew Lyons with Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Thanks, guys. Just two questions, if I could. Firstly, just on institutional expenses, you obviously highlighted the rundown in risk-weighted assets within the division and also FTEs, but I know just on page 60 that institutional expenses ex specified adjustments and FX were actually up 4% in the half. Can you just maybe describe why this is the case? I assume it relates to this timing of restructuring, but maybe on a go-forward basis, how we should be thinking about the timing of FTE, risk-weighted asset, and then subsequent expense reductions, just as far as timing is concerned.
So unsurprisingly, there are three probably, and there's probably more, but let's just say there are three big buckets of expenses in running an institutional bank. One is the people, and you've seen there that we've said that the headcount's going to come down gently, mostly from attrition, mostly from refocus, that will drive a benefit. That's A. B is incentives. That's a reasonable part of the business, and obviously that will be driven by their outcomes. And so stronger outcomes mean that, you know, that's more correlated to the ultimate profit and returns in the business. But the third one is actually technology, and technology in the broader sense of the term, i.e. the fixed costs, the DNA of building and running the place. And, you know, that's why is that a big number? Because you've got markets, which is heavily technology-focused, and same with transaction banking. The reality is today that we have a pretty stubborn cost base in institutional because of previous decisions made around some of those investments. Now, the decisions made today to accelerate depreciation will actually help the run rate going forward because, you know, by lifting our thresholds and changing what's capitalised, that actually benefits institutional by a reasonable amount, but it hasn't happened. It's going to take some time to roll through because institutional, because of those factors I talked about, tends to have a more fixed cost base than other parts of the bank. And the DNA is actually a big number and it's quite stubborn. But anyway, the real point, Andrew, is institutional is totally focused on addressing its cost base and it's doing so through in a whole range of areas that you can put under the title of basically simplifying and refocusing the business. And that's going to take some time to come through, but but you would expect to see lower costs in that business going forward.
Got it, thanks. And just a second question, maybe can you just talk about the expected payback or any more detail about the expected payback and timing of the payback from the $138 million restructuring charge? You mentioned that I think a third of it had been used this half. Any more detail just around the payback there?
Yeah, so a lot of it is in the second half of this year, so it'll be immediately apparent. So a third of the restructuring charge relates to decisions already taken, and the impact some of the impact is already in the accounts, if you will, in the first half, and two-thirds relates to identified actions that have yet to actually happen that will happen in the second half. The payback's pretty quick. As a very, very high-level rule of thumb, decisions around the restructuring, those kind of things, typically have a one-year payback as a rule of thumb, probably a little higher, but they're not 2 to 3 year kind of payback decisions in this case.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Matthew Wilson with JCP. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, guys, and thank you. You both had a central role in the mistakes of the past, and internal succession in a turnaround is therefore more challenging. You've made a start, good job, but could you have gone much harder and been more definitive today to, one, disconnect yourself from the past, and two, give yourself more margin for error? And what held you back, or will this be the first of the three customary efforts to transition?
So I have no intention of distancing myself from the past, Matt. These decisions today are not about that. This is not about clearing the decks, trying to cut from the past. This is about a recognition that the world in which we operate has changed. And we have a new team that is focused on execution and taking hard decisions. It's as simple as that. We're not going to shy away and say, I absolutely accept that we made some mistakes in the past. We overextended, we overbuilt. Fine. We can debate that. It would be a nice thing to do over a cup of coffee or a glass of wine. But the right thing to do now is, what are we doing now? And this today is about action. It's about taking hard decisions to move forward. That's what we're doing. And I know that my exco, including Graham and all the people in the executive committee, were totally committed to do that. Could we have gone harder today? Oh, I guess. But, you know, we've also got a business to run. And so we've got to get balanced outcomes. This is not about slash, burn and pair, you know, kitchen sink a result. That is not what we've done here today. This is about setting the business up for future success.
It's a disciplined response to what we see.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Just for your completeness, can you confirm whether or not you're going to sign the banking and finance oath? And where are we with the CFO change?
Sure. I have not signed the bank and finance oath, and we're having discussion with John Laker about that. This is a whole different story. This is a relatively invisible attempt. It's a good attempt to introduce an oath to the industry. Most people that you talk to in our industry have never heard of it, and so there's an issue around that. But that's a separate issue, all right? It is not because we do not believe that we have an ethical responsibility around all our stakeholders. I guess I take a view that I don't need to sign a piece of paper to do that. But that doesn't mean that I won't. I'm going to have a discussion with John. So that's that. In terms of the CFO, look, I'm very conscious this is a really important appointment. You know, of all the things that we've done and I'm going to do in my first, 3 to 6 months, it may well be the most important. And so I want to do it really carefully. And as I've said, it's a big decision to make. I'm conscious not only because we want to get a terrific CFO, but because I need somebody who's going to join and augment my executive leadership team. That's really important. And that's somebody who, as I said, augments the skills, somebody who brings something new. And so I'm taking a careful approach to that. I'm lucky that Graham is doing a great job. Unfortunately, I might have trouble getting him out of the job because he's enjoying it so much.
I love it. Just love it. Yeah.
He's loving it. Yeah. But in reality, we're not far away, Matt, from making that final decision. I know that it's been taken time, but as I said, that's because I want it to be the right decision, and I know it's a decision we're making for the very long term benefit of this group.
Good stuff. Thanks.
Thank you.
There are no further questions.
Great. Okay, that being the case, we will finish up there. But I think, Shane, did you
want to say a few little things? So thanks, everybody. Really quickly, today we've announced, I think, a really strong start to transitioning this bank. And the important thing here is that managing change of this scale is never easy. But I am personally encouraged by the vision that we've laid out for ANZ and the commitment of my team, my executive committee, and the daily support that I get on emails, texts and social media in particular from our staff and our customers. And I want to thank all of our staff and customers for their ongoing loyalty and support. And thank you very much for attending today. And as I said, I'm happy to do Apple Pay demonstrations all day long. Thank you.